Welcome to Texas Style Coworking. The Ranch Office is a neighborhood community office that delivers a warm atmosphere with a heavy dose of Southern hospitality. Located in Memorial, Katy, and Baytown, we offer private offices, conference rooms, event space, and much more. Come change things up and check us out. Remember, life is better at the ranch.
Humanity is growing and connecting. Tomorrow's world needs more energy from more places.
But to find our net zero future, we must overcome the natural constraints of many new energy sources.
This is the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast, where we look at the energy challenges of modern life and the innovators finding solutions. Join us for a low-carbon, high-energy conversation with your host, Joe Battier.
This views of the host are his own and should not be viewed as those of any business, corporation, or government entity.
Hello, and welcome to the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Battier. This is the show where we bring you low-carbon, high-energy stories from the people solving the energy challenges of modern life. I am here today with Roy Calder, oil and gas industry principal of new energies at Aviva, and Gilbert Shaheen, worldwide head of energy and utility solutions at AWS. Today, we are talking about the unified engineering approach, what it is, why we have it, and how this accelerates new projects. We will be walking through this idea using hydrogen and hydrogen projects as an example. But as you are listening, I want you to look at and think about, and I think you'll also realize that this is something that really would benefit nearly all large projects. So with that, let's get our guests on the mic. Roy, Gilbert, thank you for joining me on the show today. If you would, please share with me and the audience your background and a quick introduction to your respective companies. Gilbert, I want you to start first.
Great. Well, thank you for having me, Joe and Roy. Nice spending time with you this morning. So my name is Gilbert Shaheen. I'm the head of digital operations and also the head of solutions in Amazon Web Services focused on energy utility. I'm part of the business unit that serves our energy companies in the oil and gas and power utility space. If you're not familiar with Amazon Web Services, we are a leader in cloud computing. So we provide a global reach of cloud computing for our customers. And one thing I want to start by highlighting is the Amazon sustainability targets, which I think is important to reference in our conversation today. First of all, we co-founded the Climate Pledge, where we're aiming to reach Paris Accord agreement numbers by 2040, 10 years ahead of that agreement. We are also the largest corporate purchaser of renewable energy for years in a row. So we've acquired 20 gigawatts, more of than 20 gigawatts of renewable energy to power our business. And that is reflected with AWS aiming to be 100% run by renewable energy by 2030, with the latest forecast showing us reaching that in 2025, 5 years ahead of schedule. And this is very important framing because part of our commitment to sustainability, we're also committed to helping our customers accelerate how they develop, build out, and operate their new energy businesses, hydrogen, renewables, carbon removal. And that brings us to our conversation today. So thank you for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Great. Thank you. Roy, let's have your introduction.
Okay. Joe Bell, thank you. As we said, my name is Roy Calder. I've been in the industry now for nigh on 40 years, which is actually quite scary for me. I've been on both sides of the fence. I've been on the buyer side as well as the supplier side. I've also done project management. My background is a process engineer. And today my role is really a consultative role. And it's a consultative role between customers and our developers so that we are listening and hearing what the industry is saying in terms of sustainability, what it needs from us as a software provider, and how we deliver that into the industry. Aviva is a company made up of many, many parts, so to speak. You know, we started out in California with simulation sciences. We started out in University of Cambridge as the CAD Center. And we've all merged together with many other companies, such as OSIsoft, to become the leading industrial software company in the world. We cover the digital perspective from simulation at the beginning of the engineering process, all the way to operations, data management, equipment management, and predictive analytics. My focus today and what I'm looking to talk about really centers on unified engineering and how that fits into the project life cycle, asset life cycle that we see in the hydrogen industry today. And obviously that extends obviously into the digital twin and the digital twin into operations. So Joe, that's where I'm coming from today.
Thank you very much for that introduction. And I like the laying out of where all of this goes. And so we will touch on kind of every single one of those aspects at some point during this conversation. But I want to start off with a very important question to make sure we all have a good groundwork. When we're talking about unified engineering, what exactly is that?
Okay, that's a fundamental question because, you know, when we actually talk engineering from my generation, it's either electrical, it's mechanical, it's process, or it's automation. And it's a whole number of different disciplines that are working on a project. And until now, those disciplines have been predominantly isolated. They've been in their own little silos. They're given a piece of work to do. They do that piece of work. They hand it over. Now, unified engineering realizes and addresses the fact that everybody does not actually work in a silo. They work better together. They work better in an integrated, unified environment. So the approach that Aviva comes from is a data-driven approach whereby we actually take the process data generated by process engineers and simulation, bring it into the P&ID data-driven environment, and then feed through to all the different disciplines, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, etc., all different disciplines. Because at the end of the day, you don't have a plant designed constructed by one person or one small team. It's a huge team. And the projects we're seeing today are getting bigger and more complex, not necessarily in terms of the capital cost, because oil and gas projects are quite big. But the complexity that we're seeing in the hydrogen field with the number of players, the number of aspects that we have to deal with is really where we're coming from. And this is what is driving the industry, not only in Europe, but also in America and in the Far East. We're seeing a global drive towards this unified approach.
I think that really helps us understand what we're talking about and that first starting step of the basically breaking down the silos and trying to get everybody talking together and building a process almost, ironically, it sounds like we're almost talking about a barn raising from earlier times where the entire community is pushing up the walls all at the same time, not trying to stand up every wall on its own. So there's the conceptual side of this that is we've laid out. I feel like it should be understandable. But what is what are some hard numbers? Why do we really need this now in terms of not doing it that old way of having the silos and the isolation and kind of going from one department to the other?
Part of it's cost, the other part is time, and the other part is risk. I think what we're seeing today in the industry is there is a certain amount of risk aversion okay, out there. People don't want to commit to things that are being funded possibly by financial bodies or venture capitalists without the risk being managed. Time is always a risk, cost is always a risk, and in a high inflation environment in which we're sitting at the moment, that cost is very difficult. And we are seeing from an EPC community point of view, the drive to reduce cost and reduce time, especially when it comes to bidding. When they've got a feed package from a client, they need to bid it quickly and they need to bid it efficiently. And there's no they're much more aware that cost overruns, time overruns may not be paid the way they have in the past. On the owner-operator side, obviously, it's exactly the same message. You want to get the best bang for your buck in many respects. And especially today in the hydrogen market, the focus, because of the financial implications, is a drive not only, not really to the handover from EPC to owner, but from moving it to the beneficial operation, where the EPC has to work with the owner to get to that beneficial operation much more quickly. And that's where the unified engineering approach across both the engineering, design, and construction and fabrication stuff comes to the fore.
Very interesting. And Gilbert, did you have any thoughts to add there as well?
Yeah, I mean, just to pile on, we see a lot of our energy customers who've been in the energy space for decades, if not centuries, going into the new energy domain. And it's a much lower margin space. And it's not only lower margin, it's a moving target on lower margin. And this is driven by, right now, we see a lot of government subsidies trying to drive the economic viability of these projects that might go away at some point. And also, there's still a lot of space for the technology, the core technologies to evolve. So you're going to have a lot of competition, a lot of step change on the core efficiency of that. And we're seeing also a lot of our customers spending a lot of energy still on the demand generation side, understanding what is the demand signal from the market to consume things like hydrogen or on the carbon credit space. So lower margin is not only lower, it's going to get lower and lower and become more and more competitive. So to Roy's point, the opportunity that we see is how to leverage data across the entire process, from engineering to operations and from operations back to engineering. So there's a step change improvement on the unit economics for these new businesses. And also, how are you able to scale? One thing to highlight on top of that as well is the time frame. We see a lot of our customers trying to establish these businesses and scale them in the matter of 5 years, compared to what they're used to doing in decades timelines. So all of these factors will impose a requirement to leverage data in a much more effective way across the entire process.
Yeah, fair enough. I think those are very good points. Let's try to fill those out a little bit more. One thing you pointed out are tighter margins and moving targets for those margins. With the hydrogen market, what exactly does that mean? Are there comparisons that you can make that kind of discuss this?
Really, the market space for hydrogen at the moment is split very much between the blue market, which is traditional hydrocarbon-driven processing with carbon capture on the back end, and the green market, where you're looking at renewable energy driving an electrolysis unit to produce hydrogen. The whole infrastructure that we're seeing at the moment being built is to address the energy needs of the future. And that is a thing that is being driven partially by subsidies from central government, whether it be either side of the pond or globally. Most countries have got a hydrogen policy because they realize that's the simplest way to go forward at the moment. So what we are seeing at the moment is a demand-side-driven growth area that is based on supply contracts. Now, that supply contract may be in terms of green hydrogen. It may be in terms of green ammonia, which can then be converted back into green hydrogen. But that allows transshipment of energy from low-cost generation areas where you've got either a lot of wind or a lot of sun. So we're seeing Australia, Middle East, West Coast. I always get my east and west, but the east coast of Canada, where there's a lot of wind. And it's all being focused and driving into America and or alternatively into Japan. So the whole onus here is keeping the cost within your contracted value. Now, obviously, blue hydrogen has got a cost advantage, even when you take the capex into control against green hydrogen and its non-24-hour production capability because of, you know, the vagaries of weather. But today, the projects that we are seeing coming to the fore are all focused on one thing, and that's the levelized cost of hydrogen, trying to get that down as low as possible to drive the economics of the demand-side-driven market. Where they can get subsidies from the EU or from the Canadian government or from the US government, that helps. But the focus going forward for a lot of the projects today is minimize cost, get it done quickly, efficiently, and make sure that the project is feasible. And that's where unified engineering is finding its footprint and actually moving forward in the market.
Okay. Yep. Gilbert?
Yeah, just to add to that, I'd like to highlight that you know, from the AWS side, we spend a lot of our time helping our customers drive margin out of their energy businesses. You know, we have this framing around digital operations, which is really looking at repeatable patterns to help our customers optimize their process, improve the equipment efficiency, how to improve the productivity of their personnel and the resiliency and the performance of their supply chain. And that drives two key outcomes around improved profitability, which is better margins, and also decarbonizing those businesses. And we look at a mental model on a level of maturity. First level, looking at consolidation and visualization, right? How do you get a single pane glass view of your operation, either at a singular asset or multiple assets? One example that we have is with our customer BPX, who's consolidated a lot of their components on SCADA, Historian, to unlock automated reporting and visualization to understand how their business is running. Another level of maturity will look at things like predictability and being able to deploy large fleets of optimization models that drive things like forecasting and predictive maintenance. In another example to BPX is CEPSA, one of our refining customers, who are using our technology and the data around technology to drive better energy consumption and then more throughput through their business, 2.5% more throughput. And then the last level of maturity is what we call end-to-end orchestration. When you start closing the loop where all those data-driven capabilities are feeding back into how you're operating your business. Mm-hmm. And from an end-to-end orchestration, one example I'll highlight is Woodside, who's one of our Australian customers who's built a digital platform helping them deploy across the majority of their facilities. And one outcome they were able to drive is improved cost on maintenance, around 25% reduction, and then improved reduction in hours of labor to do maintenance. Mm-hmm. Those examples I highlight because those are with our energy customers doing the oil and gas side of the business or even power utilities. There's a lot of examples like that. That same discipline and that same approach has an opportunity to be introduced into the new energy space from day one. So the margin element is something that we deal with on a daily basis, and the technology and the tooling is already there between the examples that Rory is sharing on the unified engineering perspective, but also on leveraging the data to drive those results.
Yeah, let's talk about data a little bit more here, as those examples you're pointing out are very good examples of the of that improvement and that iteration of looking at the historical data to optimize. And this is something all of my fellow subsurface minded folks, geologists and engineers out there understand. We always want to optimize those wells, that reservoir management, to produce as much energy as possible. And so I can understand it from that historical data matching point of view, but I guess help me understand, where is the value there on the top side when we're talking about hydrogen production or one of these other industrial systems? Where is the value there with all of this early historic data into operations?
So one of the things that we are seeing more and more from our owner-operator community is the fact that they're looking to improve their operations from the get-go. So they're trying to not learn from lessons of the past, but generally do things right the first time. So what they're doing is taking the engineering data into the operational environment so that they can validate the process, any process changes, any process improvements, in a real or near real-time environment. Now, what that leads to is quite a lot of advantage to the operations staff, because they can do what-if analysis in parallel to running the plant. And that is making things a lot more efficient for that sort of operation. One of the things that is very clear is that people don't want to take a risk. So if you do this validation of process change or operational change inside the digital twin type environment, you're minimizing that risk and you can press the button and roll it out quite successfully. This is driving major projects and major undertakings in the oil and gas arena. And the hydrogen guys are learning from this because they are supplying into that market space, so they're learning. And we rely very much on the cloud here to allow that aggregated data, where you may have multiple sites needing to learn from one another rather than one isolated site. So I would love to see that we had a community of practice that would share best practices. But you know that's not going to happen. But you should have it within your own company. And that, I think, is where the benefit's going to come.
Yeah. Now, one question for both of you is, what we've highlighted are being able to move faster and reduction in time, reduction in CapEx, and also reduction in risk. As we're talking, for some reason, the phrase move fast and break things is popping into my mind as we talk about being able to move quickly with projects. And I think for some, there would be a little bit of concern here, is that as we increase speed, as we increase the availability of data and trying to move things from your electrical engineers to your mechanical engineers, maybe there's opportunity for more mistakes and there's maybe increased risk. I guess, what do you say to that?
Joe, you're quite right. And in an uncontrolled environment, that would happen. In the unified engineering environment, we've obviously put in checks and balances, but those checks and balances are also an integral part of the EPC or the engineering company's modus operandi. They've done it for years that way. They've got sign-off procedures. They've got check procedures, etc. At the end of the day, because we, from an engineering environment point of view, have integrated the process simulation into the unified engineering environment, you can go back and validate right at the principle approach, that you've got the change right, and you can mitigate that through the rest of the things. But importantly, you can actually pass that information on as a design update to OEMs, original equipment manufacturers, whether that be an electrolyzer, a compressor, or a valve or a pump. Process licensors, again, that could be the water treatment plant or anything downstream that is converting the hydrogen into, say, ammonia or methanol. And that approach is well understood and well controlled. It's not at those layers that you make a mistake. It's at the layer below. It's at that fundamental process simulation engineering transfer layer that you need to get it right. And that's what we're doing in the unified engineering environment.
And from the cloud standpoint, Gilbert, maybe you can add in some thoughts on this. Being able to, go ahead.
Yeah, so one thing to highlight is when you look at cloud technology, and a big part of the AWS tenant is to remove and reduce what we call undifferentiated heavy lifting. You see that in how we do our managed services approach, trying to take off the table the manual work that is taken to manage data, leverage data. So if you're looking at 10x, 100x more data, that doesn't mean 10x, 100x more manual work compared to what you do today. The mental model is, with the level of automation and level of managed services, you will have less manual work even at that scale compared to how you do things today. So that's an important mental model to highlight. Another thing that we hear sometimes from our customers that are not familiar with cloud with AWS is the topic of cloud security. And it's very important to highlight that if you look at AWS, we are architected to be flexible and secure and meet the security requirements for military, for government, for banks. What we call security is job zero. It's our top priority. And this really is reflected by more than 300 security services and features and more than 143 security compliance standards that we abide by. So all these things provide you with a more secure, more automated, more effective environment to operate and deliver on your work if you're on the engineering side or on the operate side. What we find is the biggest challenge to meet that scale, this is really looking at change management, adoption management. When you're introducing a new set of tools, a new ways of working, and I'm sure, Roy, you see that all the time as introducing the unified engineering approach, there's ingredients that need to be put in place to drive that adoption in an effective way. And this is what we see it as top-down alignment from leadership from our customer to make sure this is something directly connected to the business outcomes, proper resourcing and planning to provide the space to adopt new technologies, training to be able to use these tooling, and ultimately an operating model that will drive that scale, and in a sense of pragmatism. Pragmatism is very important because we always thrive to work with our customers to make sure that any technology implementation or scaling is connected directly to business value. And we've discussed some of them earlier. This is, better throughput through your process, lower carbon footprint on your process, lower total cost of ownership on your equipment. And that allows you to quickly prioritize and deprioritize technology capabilities that you're putting together. But those are key for any type of increase in work speed and scale that I think are important for any customer looking at leveraging these technologies.
How does operations on the cloud kind of get to some of those last points you made there? Things like lower emissions or cost effectiveness. How does the cloud help that?
So we can highlight kind of four key areas of how the AWS cloud helps our customers when they're operating heavy assets. One is by starting to consolidate and extend what we call the OT stack, the operational technology stack. This is your SCADA on the control side. This is historians. This is providing connectivity from your field assets to the AWS cloud. We have products like private 5G. We have Kuiper, who is a low Earth orbit project where we're going to provide high bandwidth, low latency connectivity for remote fields, remote facilities. That drives a consolidation and a total cost of ownership reduction when you're looking at the IT infrastructure supporting the systems, but then you're extending them to improve control layer and model interaction, and also extending the data into the next area, which is helping our customers create a scalable, interoperable data foundation. So Roy highlighted how unified engineering provides a unification of a lot of those data sources. This is a similar approach. It's just a bit broader because that data foundation will allow data to flow freely amongst different applications and how those are being used. The third one, we'll look at driving scale for simulation analytics. If you look at simulation, we have high performance computing, which is very important to reduce the simulation timeline for a lot of the engineering processes. It's not uncommon where we hear customers reducing their simulation time from weeks down to days, if not hours, by using high performance computing. That doesn't only reduce the timeline, but allows you to simulate a broader set of options and get better optimization. But then ultimately is how to drive large-scale analytics when you're driving things like predictive maintenance, using computer vision across your facilities, doing asset management, and reducing your supply chain, working capital, improving its resiliency. Last and definitely not least, we enable our customers to quickly deploy new ISV applications. And you know, the Aviva examples we're discussing about today is a very big highlight. But how to deploy quickly ISV applications, independent software vendor applications, in a way that reduces the time and the scale for your business, for your business outcomes. Or we also help our customers build their own custom applications. Mm-hmm. One highlight I'll mention is TC Energy, one of our customers up in Canada, developed a custom platform called Orbit, which helps them take data from multiple sources and try to maximize throughput through the existing pipeline infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And that's an example where they're still leveraging a lot of these different data sources provided by their partners. They still use the partner applications, but then they decided to go build their own custom applications. Mm-hmm. And that application layer connects directly into operational workflows that drive the business value and the business outcomes that will drive margin and also decarbonize the operations of that business.
Very interesting. I think those are that helps fill out that picture of really the values that using something like a unified engineering approach and using that on the cloud ultimately brings to a company and drives these efficiencies. Now, I know we've talked about the efficiency and the improvements on time scale and those. Roy, do you have any hard numbers that we could talk about or any examples on really when we're talking about an EPC project, we're talking about years. What kind of improvement do we actually have here in terms of this process?
So we've looked at this with a number of our clients and reviewed the benefits that they have achieved. And these are companies like Bechtel, Wood, McDermott, etc., Shell, Chevron, etc. So when it comes to just looking at taking your simulation design at your simulation into the design phase and building up that basic engineering before you go into FEED, you could easily achieve a 5% improvement in cost, overall capital cost, I should point out, as well as probably a 5 to 7% improvement on the time scale that you would do there. Going beyond that into the FEED phase and going from FEED into the execute, design and construct, you're probably looking up at a 10% improvement both on schedule and on capital cost. I think the important thing here is that it's not just the capital cost that you would have estimated using your traditional estimation tools. It's also minimizing the risk of cost and time overruns. That you can't put a figure on, because if you get it right first time, you won't have something that you can measure it against. So that's a bit of an awkward one. But the more we see this integrated approach coming through, we're seeing it being picked up very quickly by not only the oil majors, but it's trickling down very quickly into the second tier oil and gas companies, into the green hydrogen area, into the carbon capture, utilization and storage area. And those are the areas that going forward, as we look towards a decarbonized future, those are the areas where I think we're going to have to focus on. And obviously, once you've got the simulation in place, you've got the design envelope all in place, the operations staff now have got analytical tools that are really focused on that thing, and they can use those tools. And we spend a lot of time teaching our clients in many respects to actually use tools that they wouldn't normally use in normal everyday operations. It would be done by a specialist department. We're moving that into the hands of the operators. So you're empowering people. And this is, I always like to think of as engineering 5.0. Engineering 4.0 is the automation side. 5.0 brings people back into the equation. Empower the people, you'll get a better plan, and you'll get a more happy workforce who won't leave as quickly as they seem to be doing at the moment.
Yeah, it's exciting to hear the opportunity there, not only on the improvement side, but also on a way to incorporate the human and human ingenuity and the strongest computers that we have, that being our brains, back into the process. So that's very exciting. I think that is a good spot to leave this conversation and jump into the final questions. These are the questions that I ask all of my guests. So that first one being, what is a favorite book of yours that you would recommend? I think this one we'll start with Gilbert, since you haven't gotten to talk lately. So let's have you start this one.
I have to go back to my Lebanese roots, and one of my favorite books is The Prophet, written by Gibran Khalil Gibran. It's a quick read if you haven't read it, but it's really filled with wisdom and symbolism. So I definitely a must read for pretty much everyone.
All right. And Roy?
Well, my recommendation is slightly more esoteric, and it's very close to home. It's actually written by a family member of my wife, a gentleman by the name of Geert Maak in the Netherlands, and it's called The Century of My Father, and it's the life story of his father, who lived to be 101, through tumultuous times, through two world wars in the Netherlands. Now, I'll be honest with you, I'm not all the way through it. I've been reading it now for 3 years. Reason being, it's in Dutch, and my Dutch is not very good.
All right. Well, that one, I'll have to learn Dutch first, but maybe we'll be able to find a translator.
I wish.
So the next question, how do we get to net zero and beyond?
Okay, I'll take that one. One of the biggest problems I see about net zero is we don't have global consensus. Okay, we've got groups of vocal people supporting net zero, and you've got other groups that have to pay for it, and we haven't brought them together in any real manner to actually deliver this. You see strange things at the moment. You know, there's a move here in the UK to subsidize electric cars. Now, it's the people who drive petrol cars who have to subsidize cars that they can't afford, driven by people who can afford them. There's a dichotomy here that just doesn't balance up. We've got to bring everybody together and have a global consensus. And at the moment, there's too many party politics involved. That's my thinking anyway.
Yeah. Joubert, what's your personal opinion on this?
Yeah, I'm going to go back to kind of the topic we've been talking about this entire time. And there's a term I like to use with a lot of our customers called a generational evolution when it comes down to the new energy space. And going back to what Roy mentioned, how do we take engineering data, leverage it when we operate the facilities, but also how do we take all that operational data and feed it back into the engineering process? And how do we reimagine the engineering process? How do we modularize, design for reliability? And I think about if you're looking at building 50 or 100 of those facilities over the next 5 years, you're going to have to step change every facility to be better than the one before. And one of the examples of what I personally coin as generational evolution is what Amazon does with our fulfillment centers. We build a lot of these fulfillment centers and we use it's very algorithmic, very automated. And then we use every new fulfillment center that we're looking at building to inject optimization of the layout, robotics, automation. I think that muscle has to be developed for the new energy space when we're looking at using new energies that will drive the energy transition. And it'll be a missed opportunity if we end up building those new facilities using the same technology we've been using for the past few decades and saying we'll just build the first few like we used to do it, and then we'll revisit it down the road, because we're not going to revisit it down the road. So I think that's really the big opportunity. And the last thing also I think is, how do we accelerate the R&D cycle for these core technologies? When we look at things like electrolyzers for green hydrogen, when we look at carbon removal technology, how can we, as humanity basically, put the right emphasis, investment to start to step change those core processes are going to be very important for us to go to net zero and even going to carbon negative on the carbon removal side. I think those are key questions. I have the great opportunity to do this with my job day to day, and I'm looking forward to see how this progresses over the next 2 years.
Yeah, I think those are really great points, and that accelerating the R&D cycle, I think, is it's definitely one that everybody in new energy can feel and understand and relate to, and always a hot topic to discuss. But I'll leave my personal opinions for another podcast on that one. So now I will get into personal opinions with you getting to ask me a question. So Roy, Joubert, whoever wants to go first.
Yeah. So let me stick to the hydrogen theme. There's been a lot of press recently about white hydrogen, and I'd like your opinion as a subsurface engineer as to whether white hydrogen is actually sustainable or whether it's just another commodity that we're going to use up.
Truthfully, I have not looked that much into it. So it is, and I'm sure you're aware there are these different camps of white, natural, gold, all these different naming schemes of something that is hydrogen in the subsurface that you're producing, whether it's through a microbial process that you're instigating, or whether it is a naturally occurring hydrogen source. And with that caveat, I think that there is a very interesting aspect to the idea of in situ hydrogen production, no matter what that source is. And I really think that naturally occurring almost traps like oil and gas, they are going to be difficult to find, just like the same aspect of similar aspects to finding naturally occurring helium, because the helium at least is a breakdown of isotopes and requires a very, very tight seal, because we're talking about some of the smallest particles in the world or in the galaxy, and they can get through just about anything. So it's the same with hydrogen. If it is not actively being generated right now, you need a truly impermeable seal to catch that. Now, the idea of in situ hydrogen production, either through microbes or through a pyrolysis system, that I think has more weight and more potential, because now you're just needing to find existing hydrocarbons to break down and have that process occur in situ, and preferably leave that. Now it's a blue hydrogen that has the built-in carbon capture and storage. So I think that has a lot of weight, and I'm excited about that. The naturally occurring hydrogen, I haven't done enough research to give more of an opinion.
Yeah. I think we're all in the same boat on that one.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
What's your favorite SMU memory? So Roy, Joe and I went to the same school, so I wanted to get completely from left field. So what's your favorite SMU memory? Put you on the spot.
Ooh, favorite SMU memory. That's a hard question, because there are
success.
Yeah. It for anybody who doesn't know SMU, I do think there's a lot of Aggies out there that probably listen to the show, and there's a lot of traditions built in with Texas A&M. And I'm from the North, so I'm not used to all of these traditions and these traditional things for universities, but SMU also has a lot of those kind of traditions. So if you went there for undergrad, you don't step on the emblem until you graduate in Dallas Hall. And then one of the enjoyable things, of course, is boulevarding. That is a unique experience in its own. And if you don't know what it means, you just have to find out. And then, of course, the tree lighting ceremony was always one of those very enjoyable experiences that I feel is another tradition that you don't realize or you don't feel until you're actually there. So I think that there are just too many to really give one. I think those three are the things that jumped to mind right away. And I'll say this, the thing that I enjoy most now actually is homecoming. So I only live 3 miles from campus, and being able to take my son to go to the homecoming parade and to go boulevarding for homecoming and to just see what's going on. And frankly, right now we're better at football than when I was there. So it's enjoyable. Oh, yeah. You can actually go and be excited for the team and for the games. So I'll say right now, my favorite experience is homecoming, and it's a continual experience getting to experience it with my son and my wife, who did her undergrad at SMU as well. So
there you go.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Great answer.
Yep. Thank you. Good question. So Roy, Joubert, thank you for joining me on the show today. Before we sign off, is there anything else that you'd like to say?
As I said, I've been 40 years in industry. And this is the first time, when I look at the decarbonization, the green economy, et cetera, I've actually felt excited, because I can see it's not being driven by pure economics anymore. It's driven by desire and by need. And that really is what excites me. And I'm glad to be part of it. And thanks for the invite.
Yeah, I would second that. I think there's a lot of momentum. There's a lot of opportunity, and I think a lot of us and our customers are going to be balancing being ambitious and aggressive with having viability of the new energy businesses. But you know, it's really going to be very exciting. I've been part of the transformation on the digital side for a long time, and this feels like another round of transformation through our industry. So super excited to see how this goes, and we're definitely going with it for the ride. And very nice being here today. Thank you, Joe, for including me, and Roy spending the time with you today.
Well, Thank you both again for joining me on the show today. And thank you everyone for joining us on this episode of the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, share it with a friend and leave a review telling me what you're enjoying most or what you would like to hear more of. If you want more news and energy related stories, we have all sorts of energy related podcasts on OGGN. You can find them by connecting with us on LinkedIn or visiting the website. Finally, if you have any questions, comments, corrections, or have a story that you would like to share, send me an email. That email address is joe.battier@oggn.com. If you don't use email, find me on LinkedIn. And until next time, remember to keep it low carbon and high energy.
Join us again next week for another low carbon, high energy story on the Energy Transition Solutions Podcast, a production of the Oil and Gas Global Network. Learn more at oggn.com.